For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information is available at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's morning show, we're going to be talking about college and really more specifically, affording college. And more specifically than that, we're talking about what is sometimes called the free college movement or the college promise movement. It goes by different terms, but it is actually widespread and varied efforts to try to bring a college education within the realm of possibility for a wide range of people who might otherwise not be able to access such a thing. It is actually not something brand new, but in some respects, the argument or debates about free college have taken on maybe new significance and maybe also taken on some overtly political overtones. But there is, without a doubt, widespread support for at least the general notion of free college, and but just how that would look, how programs on a local or state level have been implemented in the past, vary widely. And there is a book that has just come out that is a very thorough and illuminating exploration of all of this, a book titled The Path to Free College in Pursuit of Access, Equity, and Prosperity. The author of the book is Michelle Miller Adams, who is a senior researcher at the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research and a professor of political science at Grand Valley State University, which is located not too far from Kalamazoo, Michigan, which in some respects is one of the most important places to look when it comes to this matter of free college. We'll be hearing about the Kalamazoo Promise that was instituted a few years ago, and the many imitators of it that have sprung up in its wake. And well, we have a lot to talk about. And Michelle Miller Adams, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much, Greg. I'm happy to be here.
I really have enjoyed looking at your book. It's just even more fascinating than its intriguing title suggested. So I congratulate you on that. Ahead of us talking about the book, I don't want to take too much time with this. We have a lot to explore, but I would love to hear just a quick word about what it means to be a senior researcher at the W.E. Upjohn Institute. I think most of us have probably at least a vague notion of what it probably means to do that kind of work, but can you just illuminate that a little further for us?
Sure. So the W.E. Upjohn Institute has been around for a very long time. It is a nonpartisan, nonprofit research institute based in Kalamazoo, Michigan. And I'm one of a group of researchers. Most of the researchers at the Upjohn Institute are PhD level economists, and I am not. I'm a political scientist. And I came to the institute 15 plus years ago, specifically to help the Institute and the community and the broader community understand what the implications of the Kalamazoo Promise would be. It had just recently been announced. And I've been there in capacity as a researcher for 15 years, combining that with my teaching job. So I read, I write, I talk to people, I write some more, I do some research. It's a wonderful setting to do that.
And so this book very directly springs out of that work that you have done.
Yes, it does.
As a researcher with Upjohn then.
Yes, it does. That's really where this started.
Very good. In the preface to the book, you talk about a couple of different things. One of them is that this book, at least to some extent, I wouldn't say it's the major focus of the book by any means, but part of how this book springs into being is a very personal one involving your own family and the example that your family is in terms of the significance of access to a really fine education. Explain this personal facet of the story.
Yes, I happened to be born in California at a time when college was very, very affordable. Public four-year universities were affordable. And that's no longer the case. But my own family's journey from being a very poor immigrant family headed by a single parent into providing me with a middle-class lifestyle was, the turning point was when my aunt and then my mother and her other sisters went to college in California in the 1950s. At the time, college was higher education in California was in fact tuition free. And so poor, academically reasonably talented young people could go on and get a college degree, even if they didn't have a lot of money to afford college. And I think, you know, as all your listeners know, the cost of college has risen so rapidly that that's no longer the case. But it was this access, this kind of accident of timing and this access to a high quality, highly affordable university system that really shifted my own family's trajectory solidly into the middle class. And that's what higher education does. It still does that today. Mm.
You mentioned in the very same paragraph another sort of personal connection in terms of the fact that now what you call your adopted hometown of Kalamazoo, Michigan is one of the centerpieces of this whole movement. And we'll get to that in just a moment. I want to explore the other point made in the preface, namely the timing of this book and how you began it in one world. And in a sense, by the time you completed it, we're living in a completely different world, as were all of us. And of course, people can guess that I'm talking about the pandemic. But specifically for the topic that you explore in this book, explain why you find the timing of it so intriguing.
Yes, I was very, very lucky. It takes a long time to write a book, particularly through an academic press. There are various stages of writing a proposal and having it reviewed and revising it and having it reviewed again. Plus the production of a book takes a long time as well. So when you publish a book that is about a topic that is very much in the news the same week that your book is published, there's nothing to be said about it other than that I was tremendously lucky. But yes, from the time I started the book until the time the book came out, the world changed radically in a variety of ways. I mean, I think that one thing to mention is when I started the book, the prospect for a national free college proposal was slim to none. But as the 2019-2020 presidential campaign unfolded, among the Democratic presidential candidates, and there were quite a lot, having a free college plan or free college platform became essential to everyone's candidacy. And so at the national level, this issue has moved center stage really over the course of the writing of this book. Then, of course, over the past year plus, we had the pandemic and the racial justice movement that was accelerated by the death of George Floyd. And both of those things really put a spotlight on some longstanding inequalities by race and income in our society around who gets what opportunities. We also had really dramatic changes in the economy, moving from essentially a full employment economy to record high unemployment rates, and then back to what many people are calling a K-shaped recovery, where people with more education and more money are doing well, and those without are not doing well. So you have kind of a divergence in how the recovery is affecting people. So yes, a lot has changed, and all of it, I think, has underscored the importance of access to higher education.
For those of you just joining us, my guest is Michelle Miller Adams, the author of a book called The Path to Free College in Pursuit of Access, Equity, and Prosperity. One of the other points that makes this, in a sense, a very personal story for you, and that really intersects with who you are and where you work and so on, is the fact that your adopted hometown is Kalamazoo, Michigan. And very early in the book, you spell out what is really widely regarded as one of the most significant steps in what actually is a surprisingly long tradition of trying to offer higher education to people who might otherwise not be able to afford such a thing, something called the Kalamazoo Promise. And of course, a lot of places have programs that, at least in name, bear a striking resemblance to this. I'm speaking to you from the campus of Gateway Technical College in southeastern Wisconsin, which unveiled in the relatively recent past something called the Gateway Promise. And of course, it is one of a plethora of programs with very much similar, if roughly similar, intent. But so much of this begins in Kalamazoo. Tell our listeners about what happened not long after the turn of the century, and all that we can kind of learn from this initial effort.
Right. Again, in my own case, this was, again, an accident of timing. I happened to move to Kalamazoo in 1998, and it was a kind of like a lot of other upper Midwest towns that had lost population, lost large employers, struggling, a lot of local capacity. We have a university here and some colleges, and some very farsighted community leaders and some very wealthy people who have stayed in our community, which is also typical of many upper Midwestern towns. In 2005, a group of these individuals came together to announce something called the Kalamazoo Promise. Now, we don't know who they are, because one very interesting feature of the Kalamazoo Promise is that the donors who pay for it have opted to remain anonymous. And they have preserved that anonymity for 15 and a half years now, which is a very impressive feat. But the promise was that they would pay college tuition and fees for every graduate of the Kalamazoo Public Schools District, which is a high poverty, majority minority school district that serves the urban core of our region. And the agreement is that they would continue to cover tuition and fees for graduates of the school district in perpetuity. There are very few requirements. You need to be enrolled in and a resident of the school district for a minimum of 4 years for high school, in other words, in order to receive part of the Kalamazoo Promise. And it's very clear from the structure of the program that what the donors were trying to do was both revitalize the school district and the urban core, but also attach families to the city and the school district for a longer term. And in fact, that has worked tremendously well. We've seen the school district grow by about 25%. And much of that has had to do not so much with new people coming in, but with fewer people leaving. Or what we call exit rates have gone down. So the community, a colloquial way to say that is that the community has become stickier with the promise of this tuition-free college, which you can use at one of 59 institutions in Michigan, public, private, community colleges, flagship universities. It's become harder to leave Kalamazoo Public Schools because you're giving up this scholarship. So there's an implied economic development, community development agenda at the center of this, along with the very obvious benefits for students coming out of this district that serves largely low-income students and having the issue of affording college tuition basically taken off the table for them. So that's how it started. This was the first of this generation of place-based scholarships where you get the scholarship based on where you live and where you attend school.
You mentioned that those that initiated this and continue to fund this have managed to remain anonymous, which is quite extraordinary, actually. I'm curious, do we know what the point is of that anonymity? Do we know why they want to remain anonymous? Have they communicated that to the public? I mean, the reason for remaining anonymous?
They have not explicitly communicated that, but I wrote an earlier book about the Kalamazoo Promise, and I did some research into philanthropy, and I speculated a bit about this. There is a long tradition of quiet philanthropy in Kalamazoo. We don't have a naming culture where you give money to something and then you put your name on it. That's very atypical here. I personally think by remaining anonymous, the donors were able to signal to the community that this is a community project. They are providing the money, but they are not micromanaging the program. They're not administering the program. They set program rules, but in a very general term. And it's up to the community to really embrace this opportunity and make the most of it and step up. I think the main reason for anonymity is that the donors didn't want to run this. They wanted the community to embrace it. I think they also didn't want to micromanage it. They probably also didn't want everyone and their relatives to come to them for money for their own causes. So there are many advantages to remaining anonymous when you are a philanthropist, and those are some of them.
Right. I suspect you have your suspects in terms of who this might be. Do we know how many people we're talking about that are funding?
Yeah, we don't know how many. The person who is the liaison with the donors was the superintendent at the time, a remarkable woman named Dr. Janice Brown, who really is the person who, working with these wealthy individuals, came up with this idea as a way to really improve and transform our community. She has always said they're a group of very nice people. She also says they've invested a lot of money in remaining anonymous. They have many, you know, sort of arm's length relationships between their resources and a holding company and a board and the 501c3 that operates the Kalamazoo Promise. But we do know there are a number of people and families that have tremendous wealth who live here in Kalamazoo. And their descendants live here in Kalamazoo. And so those are some of the suspects. But, you know, my assumption is it's a small group, and I have some ideas, but I certainly am not sure about the composition of the entire group. And at the beginning, that was a question that people really focused on. But I will say, in Kalamazoo, the questions about that have gone away. We used to say it was our favorite parlor game: who are the Kalamazoo Promise donors? But no one really talks about that anymore, because the program's been going on for 15 years, and it's the bills get paid reliably. They don't seem to be running out of money. Their lawyers have made various statements about their commitment to this program. So the hubbub around who the donors are, I think, has really died down.
Interesting. And did I understand you correctly that this was not the idea of these donors, but it was an idea brought to them that they embraced?
I wouldn't put it quite that way. My understanding is that as it became clear that our community was going to continue to experience these strains, the big issue here is we had a major company. In fact, my research institute is named after the founder of the company. It was the Upjohn Company, and it is a pharmaceuticals company, but it was acquired by Pharmacia and then by Pfizer. And in fact, the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine is made a couple of miles south of here in a plant that was left behind and is operated by Pfizer, the old Upjohn Company plant. And as it became clear that those kinds of corporate mergers and consolidation and job loss and migration out of Michigan was going to continue, a group of wealthy individuals sat down with some community leaders and said, you know, what can we come up with? What can we do that will change a lot? Not micromanage, but a gesture that could really change a lot of things. And the school superintendent was part of this group. And the way she tells it, she threw out the idea, well, what if everyone could go to college for free? And that was among a number of ideas discussed and the one that the donors picked up on and ran with in a big, big way. As you mentioned, there are many programs that were inspired by this place-based scholarship model, and including one at Gateway College. We have a database of about 200 college and community-based Promise programs. Gateway's program is in there, but the Kalamazoo Promise is a uniquely generous program that really brings a lot of money to students and gives them a lot of choice. And it's not typical because most communities don't have that kind of wealth in the community. So they've adopted the model, but figured out how to do it a little less expensively.
Mm. You do say in the book that, and I think it's a nice way to put it, that a lot of people think of the birth date of the free college movement as November 10th, 2005, which evidently was the occasion when the Kalamazoo Promise was first announced to the public. But you go on to say right after that, that this was actually not the first time such a thing had been done, that in fact there are, I don't know if there's a many examples, but there are some examples of at least roughly similar efforts being done before the Kalamazoo Promise. Can you help us understand how extensive those earlier efforts were, and then what was different about this one?
Yes, there were not many place-based scholarship programs. There were, I would say, a handful, and most of them were really dedicated to helping students get to college. They were not about community transformation. And so what was new about the Kalamazoo Promise is that it said, we are going to make our community a whole lot better, and we're going to do that through this very open-ended, large investment in the students leaving our public schools. So the money doesn't go to the schools, it goes to the students. But because it's such a deep and kind of deep pool of money and simple idea, it's had tremendous ramifications throughout the community. It has served, the word I use a lot is catalyst. It has served as a catalyst for the schools to better prepare students for college, for the community to step up with tutoring and mentoring and other support resources, for employers to recruit from the pool of students who are now getting a college education free, tuition free, thanks to the Kalamazoo Promise. It has changed how realtors market homes in the Kalamazoo Public School District. So it's touched on a lot of things. And in that sense, it was new, this place-based model, this idea of investing in a path to higher education as a community development tool was a new idea. I spend a whole chapter talking about historical precursors to free college. So it's certainly not the first time colleges have been tuition free, but it was a new model and a very intuitive and appealing model, which I think explains why so many communities have said, let's do something like that here.
Hmm. One of the things you point out is that there are a whole lot of things that have sprung up in its wake that are also called the Promise, the Gateway Promise being one of, sounds like maybe hundreds, I don't know, maybe thousands across the country, but of varying things and varying sizes and intentions and so on. And you say that while it is seemingly unavoidable, the definitional uncertainty is problematic. Lack of a common understanding of the field impedes progress towards an understanding of best practices and makes comparison of like programs very difficult. In other words, all kinds of promise programs have sprung up, but they are all so different from one another because there is no sort of master puppeteer making sure that they're all the same. And they probably shouldn't be all the same. springing up in different places, sometimes for different reasons or with different resources available. But just the fact that there is this wide variation also makes it difficult to, in a sense, study this phenomenon in a meaningful way. And I guess that's part of what your book is trying to do, is at least get some understanding of what kind of difference these kind of programs have made. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. And you point at perhaps the central feature of this movement that is not organized from the top down. I think I write somewhere in the book, no one owns the promise label. You can do whatever you want and call it a promise. There's no gatekeeper. There's no kind of national accreditor of promise programs. These spring up from local communities and local community colleges in response to their own local needs. And that's one of the fascinating things about the field. As a researcher, we have about 200 programs in our database that we have identified as meeting a definition that we worked out. But they include both programs based in communities and programs based in community colleges. And everyone is literally different from the other in small ways, sometimes in big ways. There is a national advocacy organization actually called College Promise, and they have a much more encompassing definition of what a promise program is. They include a whole range of programs that reduce the price of college, but don't necessarily have this place-based element. They have, I think, between 300 and 400 programs in their database. So it's hundreds, not thousands. But yes, it's a very heterogeneous field. And I, coming at this as a researcher without a clear definition or researchers really thinking about how you compare like programs, it's really hard to generate usable research. But lots of people around the country are working on it, and everyone involved in this free college movement is very aware of this challenge. Hmm.
Something else you say, this actually takes us all the way back to the preface, actually, is that this is obviously an issue that has come to the forefront. I mean, receiving much more attention, and particularly on kind of a nationwide level, than has been the case before. And for people who feel good about this being offered, this is, I mean, something to applaud, to be happy about. But you also say this is a dangerous time. You go on to say the speed of replication is so fast, and public enthusiasm for free college is so strong, that there is the real potential for mistakes. And you say, we've already seen mistakes made. That's a really interesting point, which really honestly had never dawned on me. Tell us more about the kind of things that you have seen and about this kind of danger about which you obviously want us to really be aware.
Well, I clearly wrote that line before the pandemic, because dangerous is probably an overstatement. And at the time when I was writing it, maybe it seemed dangerous, but we've seen far more dangerous things since then. But worrisome might be a better word. One of the biggest mistakes that communities can make is overpromising, announcing a set of benefits that then cannot be sustained financially, and needing to change program rules or cut back on what's being offered. That can really damage the clear public understanding of a program and make people worried about what is going to happen next. One of the attributes of these place-based scholarship programs is that they function as early awareness programs for students who may one day want to go to college. They are quite different from the way financial aid is currently structured, where when you're a senior, someone tells you to fill out your free application for federal student aid and to apply for a bunch of scholarships, apply to college, figure out how much money you get, can you get in, can you afford it, what are the trade-offs? That's how our crazy system of college admissions works. And often you don't find out about financial aid packages till very late in the game. Sometimes you have to make choices based in incomplete knowledge. There's confusion around the real price of college rather than the sticker price of college. what these promise programs do is very early on, they say, hey, you will be able to afford to go to college. It may not be as in Kalamazoo where you have 59 choices. It may be more if you're from the local area, you will be able to go to Gateway College tuition free. You may be able to go to a range of community colleges tuition free, but that promise is offered early. And so you need to be able to count on it. These are long-term programs. These are not silver bullet. We're going to announce a program and in a couple of years, we're going to, you know, wrap it up because we will have reaped the benefits. They are long-term investments. And so that's a problem that some promise programs have run into. Other worrisome issues have to do with a mismatch between what stakeholders are trying to do and then the design of their programs. So I don't want to necessarily identify specific programs, but this one's very well known. There's a place-based scholarship in Chicago called the Chicago Star Scholarship. And it's for students coming out of Chicago public schools, and they can go to a community college if they have a 3.0 GPA. And they can go to a community college tuition free. And that is not a particularly well-designed program, because if you're coming out of Chicago public schools with a 3.0 GPA, any high school guidance counselor is going to tell you, you should be applying to four-year colleges, not just thinking about community college. And yet the incentive created by the program is for students to go to the community college because they know that is tuition free. So that's just an example of and that program has still helped many students, and community colleges are a great place to go, but the terms of a scholarship can shape student decisions that may not be the best decisions for them. They may be able to find a better fit. So that's another danger. But yeah, that's probably enough.
Yeah. But it's good for us to kind of think about this other side of things. I mean, potential pitfalls and inadvertent mistakes and so on. That is part of the reality of anything. And this or whatever the good intentions might be, is certainly not a field where one is immune to these.
Right. I would add one more, and this is something that you see quite a lot, which is kind of overly complex programs with lots of requirements and hoops you must jump through to get the benefit. And that's quite typical of the scholarship field in general. But one of the findings of this 15 years of research into this movement is that simplicity is really, really important. And it's kind of a natural impulse to say, oh, well, let's make sure students do community service and take a college readiness and a financial literacy course and have good attendance in high school, and that'll set them up for success. And I understand that impulse, but actually what happens is that those requirements can interfere with the program being widely used and students really feeling that they can access it. So that's another design pitfall that we see really a lot of.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Michelle Miller Adams, and we are talking about her fascinating book, The Path to Free College, In Pursuit of Access, Equity, and Prosperity. Michelle Miller Adams, one of the points you make that really leapt out at me is when you said, tuition-free college is not a radical idea. And of course, the term radical is a real favorite now for a fairly wide swath of the American population when it comes to a new proposal that with which they are not comfortable for any number of reasons, and sometimes for very good reason, not comfortable. But you attach the term radical, and it seems like an absolutely crazy idea from some lunatic someplace who's not thinking things through clearly. And you say very bluntly here that the notion of tuition-free college does not deserve to be called a radical idea. Explain how it is not radical.
Yes, I think it's not radical in two important senses. One is that it really proposes a return to an earlier time in U.S. history when higher education was eminently affordable and accessible. And for a variety of reasons, tuition increases in higher education have just gotten completely out of hand. There's some very good reasons for this. But we have moved from a situation where a college degree was affordable for a middle-class family, and for a low-income family, it was also affordable because those students had access to federal financial aid that covered a fair amount of that college degree. And we've moved far out of that world. So in the book, I talk about earlier periods in US history when higher education was effectively tuition-free or close to tuition-free. And even as recently as when I went to college, it was cheap. It wasn't free, but it was super cheap. And so in a sense, the free college movement is asking us to return to that period when large segments of the population will be able to access a college credential or degree without taking on a ridiculous and unsustainable amount of student loan debt. The other way in which this program is not radical, and I write about this as well, is that as the world changes, as the economy and technology change, the amount of education and training that people need to be successful in the workplace changes. If you go back to the late 1800s, early 1900s, and you look at the spread of high school, which used to only be for a small segment of the population, society came around to thinking, you know, everyone should go to high school. It should be compulsory. It should be free, because you need a high school diploma to get a job. And we have moved 100 years later into a world where you really need more than a high school diploma to get a job. So what was so interesting to me about the way that the Biden administration announced its free college proposal a few weeks ago in the American Families Plan is they didn't say, hey, we want to send everyone to college for free. They said, more years of education are needed to be successful in today's economy, to have that path to upward mobility that my family had and that many of your students at Gateway College are having. And they tied together this idea of free community college, tuition-free community college, with 1 to 2 years of a high-quality pre-K on the front end, which is a very cost-effective investment that has been shown to generate huge returns. And the argument was that, you know, in the early 20th century, maybe 12 years of education was enough. But today, 12 or 13 years is not enough. Maybe it's 16 or 17 years that people need to really prepare for the current workplace.
One thing that you point out is one of the aspects of this that one might think would be fairly cut and dried, since it has to do with numbers, is in fact not all that cut and dried at all. And that is, what is college affordability and how do we measure college affordability? And you say it's much harder than it seems, in part because affordability is not the same thing as cost. Explain what that distinction is all about and why it is so important for us to somehow get a handle on college affordability and how to measure it and assess it.
Right, and I devote a big chunk of a chapter to this, so I won't go into that much detail. But I'd say, first of all, you have to distinguish between the sticker price, the published price of college, and what college actually costs. And that means accounting for financial aid. And I'm not talking about loans here. I'm talking about grant aid. Now, of course, the problem is that you can look at averages, but that doesn't mean that everyone is going to get the same amount of aid. You have students at colleges that are paying almost nothing in tuition and students that are paying tens of thousands of dollars in the private independent college sector. Not a super rational system because it isn't always conditioned by family income. Sometimes it has to do with other forms of scholarship availability. Sometimes it has to do with knowing how to access scholarships and access the financial aid system. We have students eligible for a federal financial aid for low-income students through Pell Grants that never even apply. There are so many problems with accessing financial aid, and it's such an irrational system that that's part of the problem in assessing affordability. But the other problem is that the cost of college goes well beyond tuition. And especially at community college, living expenses are almost always higher than community college tuition. So many students may find that they can afford tuition, but they have to continue to work two jobs in order to be able to pay for their living expenses. That's a huge challenge. And I think that that challenge has become better known. It's also true that our idea of who the typical student is very out of date. At a community college, the typical student is not someone who just came out of high school and is, you know, maybe living at home with their parents. These are adults. They're adults with jobs, with homes, with kids, with obligations, many of them. And so, So when you think about college affordability, you need to look beyond the cost of tuition to think about living expenses and the opportunity costs, the cost of maybe giving up some work hours so you can pay attention in class and do your work. That's another cost of college we don't always talk about.
Right. Another point of contention over all of this that I think is important for us to explore is a point in the book when you talk about the difference between universalism versus targeting. That is, creating a program which is designed with a particular population in mind versus something that is designed for anybody and everybody to access. What is at the heart of that difference, and what kind of a complication is that in all this?
So that's a big question, because that's one of the big reasons why I even wrote this book, to try to get at the idea that stakeholders, people who come up with this idea to launch a free college program, are trying to accomplish different things. Sometimes communities are saying, well, let's offer a scholarship to students who do well in high school, so we'll create this carrot for them to do well in high school. And the research that's coming out, in fact, some of it quite recent, shows that doesn't work. There may be students right at the margin who can nudge their GPA from a 2.4 to a 2.5 and get the scholarship. But many students are going to fall well below that and in fact be discouraged by that GPA cutoff. I'm a big fan of universal programs, because I feel like really everybody deserves a shot at getting some kind of post-secondary education and training. And I said that carefully. I didn't say college, because sometimes the term college is misconstrued as meaning everyone should go out and get a four-year bachelor's degree. And that's not what the free college movement is about. There are career and technical ed and short-term certification training programs offered by community colleges, including the one where you're sitting, that are almost everyone can find something of interest to do that they're going to be able to do. So really creating a very broad universal access system is the one that's going to give you the most returns, both in terms of creating a better trained workforce, but also really allowing people to get the highest return on their human capital. Yeah, I had another thought that I wanted to share, but it's gone straight out of my head. So I'm a big fan of these universal programs. I'm quite grateful that the president's plan is universal, because I think it offering some opportunity to everyone. Oh, I know what I was going to say. There's a ton of evidence in the U.S. that when you make a social program universal, it creates a lot of political support for that program. You can think about things like Social Security or Medicare, which are not income-based programs, and they extend to everyone. And they have tremendous political support and broad buy-in across the political spectrum and across the income spectrum. So when you narrowly target these free college programs, not only do you cut a lot of students out of the opportunity, but you also really narrow the base of community support for these programs. So that's another reason why I'm a fan of universal access programs.
How about the matter of shifting this to the federal, national level, and in a sense, out of the more local or state realms where where this is happening right now. And of course, your book points out some of the ways in which that makes a lot of sense. That is, for things to be wed to the local level or the state level and closely tied to particular settings and particular populations. And we're talking about something different when it becomes kind of a federal thing, a sweeping in its scope and so on, with access to vastly wider amounts of resources, but also kind of a scope of oversight that's kind of staggering and leads to all kinds of potential complications. What do we need to think about when we talk about providing this on that kind of a scale?
Right. It's a very, very hard thing to do because, of course, as you point out, education is not a federal responsibility in the U.S. It's decentralized. Higher ed is basically operated at the state level. K through 12 is operated at the local level. We really have, I mean, maybe not 50, but close to 50 different systems of higher education in the U.S. States invest different amounts of money in their higher ed sector. They give different amounts of money to students. They have different types of institutions. And so when you're trying to go from a series of state initiatives to a federal initiative, it's hard to do. And of course, the people working on this know this. And we have some other examples of programs that are operated at the state level but funded by the federal government, which is what is being proposed. This would be a shared federal state responsibility. Most of the money would come from the federal government, but states would need to buy into the program and provide some portion of funding, and of course would still operate their higher ed sectors. But right now the situation we have is so unequal. If you live in Tennessee, you have access to tuition-free community college, whether you're a recent high school graduate or an adult without a degree through the Tennessee Promise and a program called Tennessee Reconnect. But if you live in a neighboring state, you don't. And if you happen to live in Kalamazoo and attend the Kalamazoo Public Schools, you have this incredibly generous scholarship. But if you're one school district over, you don't. So there's tremendous inequality of opportunity when it comes to tuition-free access to higher education. And the program announced by the Biden administration, which is very similar to something that had been proposed by President Obama back in 2015, it sets a floor under what states and localities are doing in the free college area. And it basically says to everyone whose state buys into this, you will have the opportunity to go to a community college and do any one of a number of different types of degrees or programs without paying tuition. It will become essentially automatic. No one's going to force you to do it, but if you choose to do it, you will not struggle to cover tuition costs.
Hmm. We should mention.
Yeah, it's hard to do, but manageable.
Yeah. Your book goes on to explore some of the very specific reasons why the notion of free college is pursued as energetically as it is when it comes to matters of access and equity and prosperity, as are spelled out in the book's subtitle. And your book at the end makes some at least general recommendations about if such an initiative were indeed to be launched, what are some of the things that might help ensure its success? Things like making sure it's simple and making sure it's fair and making sure its intentions are clearly communicated and so on. And your book also explores some of the reasons why the cost of college has skyrocketed in the way that it has. And of course, that brings to mind other possibilities about trying to, at least to a point, rein those costs in. Your book gives us all kinds of things to think about and reflect upon. And again, it's titled The Path to Free College: In Pursuit of Access, Equity, and Prosperity. It's published by Harvard Education Press and the author, Michelle Miller Adams. Michelle Miller Adams, I have really enjoyed this conversation thoroughly. I learned a great deal from your book. It gave me a lot to think about, and I suspect for anybody who is interested in this topic, and that should be all of us, they will enjoy this book as I did. Thank you for being part of The Morning Show, and thank you for writing this great book.
Thank you so much, Greg. And I really appreciate your thoughtful questions about it and an opportunity to talk about the book with your listeners. So really appreciate being on your show.
Tomorrow.